second case of the day, EEOC versus Aerotech. Mr. Herka.
Your Honors, may it please the Court. We are here today as a result of the EEOC's efforts to enforce an administrative subpoena in district court. The first issue before this Court is whether the Commission satisfied its statutory and regulatory prerequisites to this enforcement action. Specifically, whether the decision of two Commission members to deny the petition to revoke or modify the subpoenaed issue failed to comply with the quorum requirements of Title VII and its accompanying regulations.
If we sent this back, what is to stop the EEOC from denying the motion to revoke with its new quorum and then filing another enforcement action?
Your Honor, there is nothing to stop them. If this were to go back and go through the proper procedures under the regulations and the code, as far as the petition to revoke or modify, if there were a quorum of the Commission, which there currently is, then nothing stops them from reviewing the petition and issuing a determination. In fact, they're obligated to do so. And so, however, the whole purpose of that is to maintain a quorum is that you have a sufficient nexus of the Commission, sufficient body, such that they can issue a determination. So in reality, Your Honor, the point is that it would go back, we could get the petition back in front of the quorum, and they can make a determination based on the facts before them.
Now, what about Chevron deference? Don't we usually defer to an agency's interpretation of its own rules? And there's no statutory bar, is there, to the EEOC filing an enforcement action in these circumstances? You know, see, your claim seems to be that it violates their own regulations.
Well, it violates the statute and regulations, both 29 U.S.C. 161 sub 1, and 29 CFR 1601.16, B2. In the code and the regulation, it provides for a respondent to petition to the Commission to revoke or modify a subpoena. And then under that provision, it states specifically, and uses the term shall, the Commission shall then consider and issue a determination with regard to that petition.
But there's no statute, is there, that prohibits the delegation?
Your Honor, it's the quorum provision of the statute itself that requires action by three, not less than three individuals. That's the prohibition here, Your Honor, is that there is a specific statutory provision, and that is 29 U.S.C. Section 161, that provides for the fact that there must be three individuals to constitute a quorum.
Why do we need to even consider the quorum problem when you submitted your request to modify the subpoena 5 months too late?
Well, I don't believe that's the allegation. First of all, there is no record as to the untimeliness of the petition being submitted. That was not raised at the district court level, and it's untimely, and it's been waived. In fact, if you look at the timeline, I believe that the petition was actually submitted approximately 2 weeks after the decision by the Commission. But, again, the EEOC did not raise the issue of waiver at the district court level.
Did you raise the regulation argument below? Because I didn't see any reference to it until your reply brief.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Can you clarify?
I think it's unclear whether or not you raised the regulation argument in the district court because as I said, I first saw it come up in your reply brief.
All right. And, Your Honor, are you talking about the fact that the Commission must first issue a determination before the EEOC may come into court?
You know, whether the subpoena should be enforced, whether the EEOC had the likelihood to file the enforcement action.
Your Honor, I believe it is in 29 CFR 1601.16 that provides specifically in the first section that the EEOC must consider and issue a determination. It is a provision thereafter that provides the EEOC, grants it the authority to then proceed to district court to enforce the subpoena. If the EEOC were permitted to go to court and seek to enforce a subpoena without first proceeding through the commission process, then that would render it a nullity. It is not a voluntary process whereby the EEOC can decide to waive that process. Again, it speaks in terms of mandatory action that they shall act. Otherwise, if the EEOC can avoid that merely by running into court, that paragraph would be useless. And so you have to read the two provisions together, the first of which requires that when the respondent does petition the commission must issue a determination.
See, you're claiming that the EEOC violated its own regulations. But I'm asking whether you raised the regulation argument below.
We did, Your Honor. We raised the issue below, the fact that they, under 29 CFR 1601.1, must, upon a petition, issue a determination, and that must be review and final determination. That's the language of the statute, or of the regulation. And that was specifically addressed with the district court, the fact that they have a statutory and regulatory obligation to consider a petition for revocation. And in this case, there is no dispute that at the time there was a determination on the petition at issue, there were only two commissioners. And, of course, they attempt to circumvent that by saying that at the time there was a quorum, they had delegated those responsibilities to a less-than-quorum two commissioners. And then they claim that afterwards the actions of those commissioners were ratified by a single document.
Right.
And we believe that doesn't remedy the situation. That is merely a runaround the quorum requirement. As you can imagine, a situation where a quorum of a government agency decides they want one person to act for the next year on behalf of the agency, they can do that by writing, and then at the end of the year, with a single signature, say we ratify all their decisions.
Okay, now let's talk about, please, what they're seeking, what the EEOC is seeking. Because it seems quite obvious that evidence of systemic discrimination tends to prove a claim by an individual of particularized discrimination. And in a regular discovery setting, the evidence that the EEOC is seeking would be completely appropriate. So why isn't it relevant to the individual claims here?
Your Honor, I disagree with that conclusion, because the two charges at issue here, which were filed in 2008 by Mr. Rivera and Gutierrez, were both national origin discrimination claims based on their Mexican background, Hispanic background. They were disparate treatment claims, individualized claims that they themselves suffered discrimination of national origin. They were both working in the same facility at that time. They make no allegations of pattern and practice. They make no allegations of any...
No, but they make allegations of having found evidence of systemic discrimination.
That is not the charge, Your Honor. That is the EEOC's declaration in support of the subpoena in the district court. And the problem we have here, Your Honor, is that the charges themselves make no allegations of systemic discrimination, no allegations of pattern of practice, no allegations of any similarly situated people who've endured such discrimination.
Yes, but evidence that an employer is engaged in systemic discrimination would support an individual claim of discrimination. So the evidence that they are seeking is related to the individual claim.
Your
and
Honor,
that's all you need, it seems to me. Dissuade me.
Your Honor, I think it's a step removed from the process. The relevance requirement is statutory. It's under 42 U.S.C. Section 2000E8A. It is that the subpoena must be relevant to the charge under investigation. The charge under investigation does not make any allegations of pattern of practice. And keeping in mind, too,
see, we're at apples and oranges here.
And perhaps if I take the next step,
I'm apples.
I'm orange, I understand.
Okay.
Taking the next step, what they're seeking are not documents or information related to these two individual charges, who were, by the way, internal employees of Aerotech. They were recruiters. They are seeking information for all internal employees at six different locations around Illinois, as well as all external or contract employees, keeping in mind that the organization sends employees, contract employees, to their clients. And so we're talking about tens of thousands of individuals who work at clients' locations around Illinois, and they're seeking information about them. And they've given no explanation how it is that they can go from two individual disparate treatment claims of national origin, expand it to not only internal but external employees who don't even work at Aerotech's facilities, and how they go beyond national origin to cover date of birth, sex, national origin, and even disability, according to the district court, and gender. So what they've done is they've basically taken two individualized charges and tried to expand them and explain that they can use them.
Have you ever dealt with the EEOC before?
Many times, Your Honor.
Yeah. Well surely this has hit you before.
Generally, it hasn't, Your Honor. I'll tell you why. Because the claims they are making in their documentation submitted to the court, again, are not related to the underlying charges. They are brand-new allegations which could have been the subject of a commissioner's charge. Had they issued a commissioner's charge, we would not be here.
Look, we're talking about discrimination here, systemic discrimination.
I understand that, Your Honor. But if they were bringing a claim of systemic discrimination with regard to external employees, they should have amended the existing charges or issued a commissioner's charge.
You just gave them an idea.
Well, if they do that, they can do that. But they haven't done that, Your Honor.
Well, doesn't the subpoena basically request general demographic information about employees? And we permitted the EEOC to obtain this kind of information in the Temple Steel case.
Your Honor, it actually does not. This asks not only for basic demographics, it asks for information relating to internal and external contract employees, including, like you said, demographics, name, date of birth. But also beyond that, it asks for information such as the dates of application. They ask for information relating to the reason they were selected or not selected for a particular position with one of Aerotech's clients, the positions they sought, account information with regard to the clients, contracts between thousands of clients and Aerotech, and dates of assignment. It goes well beyond basic demographic information. And we're talking about potentially tens of thousands of employees. And again, all premised on two individual charges of discrete discrimination. And this goes back to the relevance standard, which is, again, statutory, and it was outlined by the Supreme Court in EEOC versus Shell Oil Company, that there must be, quote, an established a linkage between the commission's investigatory power and charges of discrimination. There is no charge out there making this allegation of pattern and practice or systemic discrimination. That is what they put in their brief. That's what they told the district court. But there is no charge out there alleging that. And so there is no link to relevance here. What the EEOC is saying, we can take any charge we would like that alleges discrimination and take our word on it if we say it's systemic in nature. That is not the standard, because that's what they're alleging here, that take our word on it, we found a lot more, therefore let us go reach out to tens of thousands of people. That is not a standard.
So then what's your position on how the EEOC should have responded to the additional claims of discrimination it uncovered?
Well, if you're referencing the 10 other charges pending.
Right, exactly.
First of all, I'll just reference the Burlington Northern Santa Fe case in the 10th Circuit, which came out recently, that rejected the idea the EEOC could bootstrap or stockpile EEOC charges. With regard to that, Your Honor, I'll note that those are 10 charges filed against the company over a six-year span. You're talking about a company with, at that time, 77,000 employees with a very high turnover rate. So any large organization that has tens or hundreds of thousands of employees, by its very nature, is going to see a certain level of EEOC charges filed against them. Your largest employers are accustomed to having dozens, hundreds of charges filed against them. That itself doesn't give them the authority or warrant them to expand an existing charge well beyond a facility, well beyond the type of employee at issue, into a broad group of tens of thousands of people. And the 10 charges, by the way, that were not even presented to the district court are nowhere in the record. All you have is a representation by counsel that there are 10 others, and therefore there must be a pattern here. Well, we can represent to you, as we did to the district court, two of those charges were settled, three post-date the subpoena. So the fact that they rely on charges filed after the subpoena was issued is improper. And overwhelming majority of those charges also relate to allegations brought by external employees who didn't work at Aerotech's location but at the client's. And so merely coming in here and holding up like a deck of cards, hey, we have 10 charges, where there's smoke, there's fire, that doesn't meet the relevance requirement, because with any large employer, the EEOC could simply stockpile charges over a number of years, then march into court and say, we have X number of charges, therefore give us everything we're asking for. That's not the standard.
What additional information would you have to gather in order to, you're arguing that this will be a great burden to produce the electronic spreadsheets.
It's not a spreadsheet. I think we indicated in our brief, Your Honor, that to produce a small subset, a partial response to what they're seeking here, and at that time it was merely two categories of documents, and it was a two-year period of time for one facility, that required hundreds of hours of work, months of work, and resulted in approximately 13,000 pages of documents.
You know, I'm a little troubled by your argument, because I can't believe that the HR department of a company your size could not produce most of this information electronically in a few weeks. Because you argue that not all of the information requested is kept electronically, but you never say what is missing. What is the information that you don't have in electronic?
Your Honor, this is an interesting organization in that, like other organizations that recruit individuals for clients, they have to maintain records of people brought on board, referred to various organizations. And again, we're talking just in Illinois, tens of thousands of people during this period of time. And so what happens oftentimes is those individuals are then presented to the client, who ultimately selects these individuals to work for them, sometimes on a temporary basis, sometimes long term, okay? Sometimes referred to as contract employees or temps. And so with that, there's certain information that is maintained and isn't maintained. First of all, we don't maintain information about disability, which the district court said we had to produce. We don't maintain information about race and national origin unless they self-identify. And furthermore,
don't you have to under the law?
We do not, Your Honor. We as a staffing organization are not required to maintain that information. And so when your question about what do we not have, the problem you have is they seem to appear to believe that we are making the decisions who gets hired with which client of Aerotech's. That is not how it functions. We refer individuals to the client, who then selects people to hire. And so there's really a multiple-step process involved. So they're trying to treat us as if we are a traditional employer, that we are hiring people and making decisions ourselves. And in that situation, you would expect that, yes, you'd have the basic information. But here, if they want information about why somebody was selected for a position, we don't maintain that information. That's held with the client. If they want information about why they were not hired.
You never go back to the client and say, you know, why, what was wrong here?
Well, no, because we will refer individuals to them, and they may turn down a number of individuals and say, out of 10 individuals you refer to us, we want 3. But we don't go back and ask them to fill out forms and explain why they didn't pick those 7. And so that's the problem we have here. This is not merely pulling up PeopleSoft and printing it off. This is having to go out there and rebuild information from the last 6 years. And again, the problem we have is not only is that an incredible burden that would take many, many months and thousands of man hours, but it's also something we ask ourselves, how is that related to the two individual charges that are the basis for the subpoena? The subpoena only identifies 2 charges, and there are no allegations of pattern and practice. And that's where we have a problem here, Your Honor, is that they have a very broad subpoena seeking information about tens of thousands of people, both internal employees and external, based on 2 subpoenas that are individualized disparate treatment claims.
Well, as the internal, you don't have quite the same objection, right?
We still object, but it's a different issue.
I'm not asking you to withdraw that, Mr. Herka, but it is a different focus, is it, the internal?
The difficulties are exponentially worse when it comes to external employees. That is correct, Your Honor. It really, truly is, only because you have different components involved. Internally, we still think that it's inappropriate. We object to it because, again, we're talking about two individuals who resigned from the same location, and now they want to expand that inquiry for 6 years to all six locations. So, yes, although our primary biggest objection is to the external employees, it's also with regard to internal.
Do you want to save some time?
I would like to reserve time as well.
Thank you, Mr. Hurkin.
Thank you.
Ms. Bruner?
May it please the Court. My name is Paula Bruner, and I'm counsel for the EEOC, appellee in this subpoena enforcement appeal. Excuse me. The Supreme Court in Shell Oil has declared that the Commission's investigatory authority is broad. And what we have faced here in this particular case is a lot of delay tactics by Aerotech in our effort to determine whether or not the charges that have been filed have any veracity.
What is the source of the EEOC's power to delegate its authority to the two remaining members? Are there any decisions at EEOC that require only a single commissioner or two commissioner? I take it the usual practice is to have a quorum. But why define a quorum at all unless it's required to transact business?
To answer the first part of your question, is there any authority? Title VII is our authority, Your Honor, where it specifically states that no vacancy should impair the operations of the agency continuing.
Ms. Bruner, if I could just stay with that point for a second.
Yes, Your Honor.
Doesn't that make the absence of the delegation that you have in Title VII remove the force of the quorum requirement?
Remove it when we have a number of members that are less than three, Your Honor. There is no delegation.
No, that's right.
Provision that's right. In Title VII.
Right.
What we have is Title VII's provision leading off that no vacancy should impair the remaining members without quantifying
what do we do with the quorum? What if we're down to one EEOC member?
Typically, what has happened in the past, to answer also Judge Rovner's decision, is that question rather, is that a quorum has, in anticipation of a vacancy that's less than three member, have delegated to the remaining members the authority of the agency, consistent with Title VII's initial provision, which allows the remaining members to operate with all power of the commission. And therefore, that is what happened in this case. Before, there were only two members, three members of the commission issued this delegation order.
Well, what
and
if
it's
that,
only temporary.
What if that delegation
nature.
Order, when you had three, said that one member can issue subpoenas, and then the vacancies occur such as there's only one member in the entire commission. And so that one member could exercise based on even there's no quorum now physically possible. That person, under your theory, could exercise?
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact, this, unlike the NLRB, this agency has had been down to one member.
That's right.
And has continued to operate on behalf of the commission.
Yeah, let me take you then to new process.
Okay.
As you might suspect, I'm particularly sensitive to the teachings of new process. I have a problem in your distinguishing a new process. I'm not unsympathetic to your position today because that's not a position that I was unsympathetic to in new process, but I was informed by five members of the court that that's not an approach that they found appropriate because of a lack of a statutory authority to... They understood the practicalities, as I do in your case. But where would the statutory authority be, other than your broad quoting of Title VII, that would allow it to devolve to, let's say, less than three members when you only have two or one member left on the commission. Don't you think the teachings of new process caution against operating with less than a quorum?
I think that the Supreme Court approved what you were attempting to do across the board with respect to adjudicatory decisions. In this particular case, an action on a petition to revoke is not an adjudicatory decision. It's not self-executing. It's not binding. And therefore, if Aerotech, as it did in this case, does not wish to comply with the ruling of the commission, it has a right to and did resist compliance and force the commission to come to the district court to have it executed. But I think what's most important about this quorum issue and why it is a distraction is the fact that Title VII does not require a petition to revoke or modify or a ruling on that petition in order for the commission to be able to bring a subpoena enforcement action. We can file an application just simply on the basis that the respondent has continued to comply with the subpoena as issued and seek enforcement in the district court. And we think that if you have any qualms about new process steel and quorum issues, that that could be the clean basis on which to resolve this matter, that being there are no prerequisites except that there be a valid charge and that there be continued resistance by the respondent in order for the district court to entertain the commission's application. If there are no further questions on the quorum issue, I'll move on to the merits.
Can you just speak to this timing issue? Because one of the arguments you make is that, you know, we really don't have to get into the quorum business because they were late in terms of filing their objections 5 months late. Can you just speak to that?
Yes, Your Honor, and that is another basis on which to resolve this matter because the two members of the commission did first note that the petition itself was untimely, and therefore there was no obligation to actually rule on it. But in the interest and spirit of being informative and encouraging to, in terms of explaining why they should comply with the commission subpoena, the members then did go through, look at the different requests that were made, made modifications and concessions, did in fact set aside a couple of the requests, and tried to create a scenario that would be more, that would make it easier for Aerotech to satisfy the requests and demands of the subpoena. And yet and still, Aerotech did not. And even after that time period, the Chicago office attempted to confer and negotiate with Aerotech to get it to produce information that was relevant to the charge. Again, moving to the merits, Judge Williams, with respect to the timeliness issue, an untimely petition is no petition, and therefore further fortifies the foundation that a petition itself is not warranted in order for the district court to entertain the commission's petition for enforcement.
Ms. Bruner, speaking to the scope of the subpoena,
yes,
the initial inquiry, obviously, by the EEOC is the result of two internal employees making the charge of discrimination. What is the basis to decide to go to the external before you've completed the examination of the merits of the and determined the validity of the internal employees? Since this has a, I don't want to say unique, but a slightly different operation than many large corporations, as Mr. Herka has pointed out.
Your Honor, the uniqueness of this company, that being a temporary employment placement agency, in and of itself makes the breadth of our request pertinent to the allegations. One of the allegations in the charge that is in the body of the charge, even though the commission is not required to just limit itself to what's stated in the charge, is that Aerotech had engaged in national origin discrimination based on job segregation, meaning only certain people were placed in certain jobs. And in the course of the commission investigators' interviews, of the charging parties and witnesses. He also learned that this type of honoring of client discriminatory preferences in job placement also was on basis such as race, national origin, sex, age, and disability. And so what we see here is there being a nexus where under Shell Oil, if there is evidence that this company is discriminating with respect to condoning discriminatory client preferences in its job placement of the contract employees, we believe that will also cast light on whether there's any veracity to the charging parties' claims that they were prevented from being promoted to certain positions, being trained for certain positions, or being segregated to certain positions because of their national origin.
Yeah, but, you know, Aerotech has cited the language in our United Airlines opinion that says if in the course of investigating an individual complaint you discover a broader pattern of discrimination, you're free to file a commissioner's charge that incorporate the new allegations and thereby you can expand an investigation. Why hasn't the EEOC done that here?
Well, Your Honor, while we are correctly free to file a commissioner's charge to pursue those line of in that line of investigation as it relates purely to those contract employees, it is not necessary in this context because we feel that that information has bearing on the two charging parties' allegations and that having the avenue of filing a commissioner's charge is not a preclusion to us being able to solicit that type of information in the course of this investigation.
So your request for data can just be never-ending? Is that what you're saying?
No, Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that at all. But what we do have here is a direct correlation regarding employment practices and with respect to hiring and job placement and job segregation that are so closely tied together that to find evidence of this company discriminating on prohibited factors could shed light and demonstrate whether this is a pattern in practice throughout this particular company.
Under your theory, then, under every kind of case like this, the EEOC could just look at all the employees because there is still going to be a potential that you're going to find support for the one or two people that have actually filed charges and made allegations.
Well, Your Honor, we're not going as broad as that. We did limit our, the scope of our subpoena to six offices within the Chicago metropolitan area, not even the entire state. Even though this is a company that has offices nationwide, we also limited it temporarily from 2006 to present, which at that time was 2009, which covered the employment period and 1 year after the charge was filed. And we were very reasonable about not only geographically and temporally, but we were very reasonable about the type of practices we were looking at, that being hiring and job placement. So while we're not asking for and haven't asked for Aerotech to produce data on demographic or otherwise on every single employee that it has that it controls, both internal and contractual, we have asked in a narrow scope for information that we feel will shed light on the veracity of the allegations in the charge before us. If there are no further questions.
I guess, Judge Williams, do you have anything further?
Oh, that's it.
Well, I wanted to say a couple of things about undue burden, if that's okay. Just that mainly the Aerotech did not present any information regarding undue burden to the district court. Instead, it made conclusory allegations. And while it cites this entire passage from United Airlines.
Forgive me, but so now are you responding to my question about the regulations? See, I wondered if you ever had a real opportunity to respond to that argument because most of it was in the reply brief. Argument about the fact that the EEOC has not followed its own regulations.
I thought that was in the context of the quorum issue, Your Honor. Yeah. Are we back to that?
Okay. I am back because I don't want you to sit down yet.
Okay, all right. I won't then. with respect to the quorum issue, we did follow our regulations, and we also followed the statute. The regulations do not have the mandatory language that Mr. Herka suggested.
No. Well, you know what I want to know? Do you believe that you had a real opportunity to respond to that argument?
I did, Your Honor, okay. And I believe that the response is a petition to revoke and a determination on that petition is not a prerequisite to a subpoena enforcement proceeding, that the district court has jurisdiction whether any petition was filed or a petition was filed, as in this case. So the cleaner response is that it's immaterial okay. to whether or not the district court could entertain the enforcement application.
Just ask you one question, Ms. Bruner. Again, to the initial internal complaints by the two individuals, is it your position that their complaint about the promotion discrimination that attends their accusation gave you information about this temporary 77,000 as to who the client takes or does not reject? I'm trying to get the linkage. I understand the power of the commission. I'm just trying to get the linkage.
The linkage is that we have two charging parties who are uniquely placed to know not only what is happening to them, but what are happening to other employees, both internal and external, within their locations.
So they're the wellspring of arguably information about this client rejection or
yes, Your Honor.
Potential discrimination in the number of people that are sent out and accepted.
Yes, and that's where our investigator initially heard and learned of other types of discrimination that was occurring because they themselves were being directed place certain people because of their origin or age.
Now, in this kind of setting, would the commission make inquiry also of those clients before deciding about the breadth of the externals? In other words, would you take a sampling, use subpoena power to examine, let's say, 10 of the employers who are significant people who hire, you know, based on the information you got, let's say, from the internal? I mean, is there any way to kind of validate the judgment that you need to spread to the 77,000 because you've sampled and kind of justified your initial suspicion that there might be discrimination flowing, arguably in your position, in concert between Aerotech and those clients?
At some point, Your Honor, the commission probably would ask the clients directly questions about their employment practices. In this particular case, we did ask Aerotech to identify for us which of their clients hired and some of their employees and the demographics of the persons who were hired and as well as those who were not. Because, again, the focus is on Aerotech in this context and not on the specifically on the clients themselves, their clients themselves.
So the commission's concerned about steering rather than the position of the employers on who they want? Would you say that's your focus, the commission's focus?
The commission's focus is on whether Aerotech is discriminating not only against its own employees,
but also
contributing to discrimination against the employees that it places, contract employees that it places, all of which is related to hiring in a tangential sense.
All right.
I did want to say one thing on undue burden, if that's okay.
Surely.
Okay. And that's just that mainly the district court was correct in rejecting Aerotech's attempts to, as it does on appeal, to now offer some substantive data as to why it would encounter an undue burden if it had to comply. We ask that this court, in affirming the district court's decision, that it not only request hold the judgment, but that it requests documentation be produced in electronic databases, which Aerotech has never clearly explained why it cannot do, and also that deadlines be imposed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brewer. Mr. Herkos?
Your Honors, I'd like to address just a few points, if I may. With regard to Judge Robner, you had a question about, or at least you had a quizzical look about why the company did not maintain certain demographic information. That is because the fact that the definition of an employee for record-keeping purposes under the EEOC and OFCCP regulations excludes temporary employees, and that's why they don't maintain that information. And so for these external employees who are, by definition, temporary employees assigned to Aerotech's clients, we're not required to maintain that. Now, Judge Williams, you had questioned myself as well as Ms. Bruner about the waiver issue, whether or not we waived our arguments because the claim is that our petition was untimely. For clarification purposes, the subpoena was issued on September 15, 2009, and the petition was sent on September 29, 2009. So it wasn't 5 months. It was less than 2 weeks. And it's 5 days from the receipt of the subpoena that you have the ability to petition. And so there's an issue of fact as to when it was received, but none of that is before the court here, as none of this was raised in the district court, and there is no factual record on that point.
Okay.
As to the relevance, Your Honor, I think that it became abundantly clear that here there is no relevance analysis conducted by the EEOC. There simply is no link between what they are seeking and what is identified in the two charges at issue. And Judge Flom, you made a very good point, which is even if the charging parties at issue are alleging that they themselves were not promoted, how does that translate into a client of Aerotech requesting specific types of people or people based on improper characteristics? Those are two separate distinct actions. One is internal employees claiming that Aerotech did not promote them within the organization. The other is that Aerotech gives in to the whims of its clients who make discriminatory decisions.
Well, I appreciate that point, Mr. Herka, but as I understand Ms. Bruder's response is that because of these two internal employees hold these recruiter positions, they arguably possess an insight into the other challenged area. Are you suggesting that's a bridge too far? I have no knowledge, of course, what was conveyed by those employees, but could they be the wellspring, as I say, of information as to this other aspect dealing with the external?
Your Honor, I do believe it is a bridge too far, even though they can be a wellspring. If that is a separate and distinct claim, apart from the two pending charges, as we've mentioned a few times, they have every right and ability to issue a commissioner's charge. And that would set the clock going on that matter. That would put the employer on notice pursuant to the regulations and the statute and allow the company then to respond to those allegations. Here what they've done instead is they rely on two charges and then don't tell you until you get into court and they try and force a subpoena. I see my time is up, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.